This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Peter Sagal, hosts NPR's news quiz, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. But when not reading the newspaper, he's been watching some pretty things at a fetish ball, a swingers club, a porn set, and strip clubs. That doesn't make him a voyeur, I don't think, because it's research for his new book, The Book of Vice. The book isn't just about sex. No, it's also about such vices as lying, gambling, and gluttony. Although Sagal remained an observer during his research, he did briefly become an active participant in the gluttony. The subject matter of Sagal's book may surprise Wait, Wait listeners, so might the fact that he ghostwrote the memoir of a porn director. What isn't surprising is that, like Wait, Wait, the book is smart and funny. Let's start with a reading from the Book of Vice.
This is actually from the first chapter of the book, and my wife Beth and myself are visiting, as observers only, I should say, that was the terms of the visit, a swingers club, which I identify in the book with the bad pseudonymous name, the Swingers Shack, because the people there did not know that I was going to be writing about it, and therefore I want to maintain everybody's secret identity. Before coming here, I had sworn to Beth, absolutely truthfully, that I didn't have any interest in participating in the evening's activities. She had said the same thing, of course, but she wondered if I was telling the truth, or even if I was speaking honestly in the moment, how I would react once we were there. I wondered the same thing myself. Would the presence of so much flesh and opportunity overwhelm my ironic distance? Would I look around at the mattresses on the floor and the sponge-stippled walls and the rationed condoms and plastic bowls and say to myself, finally, I am home. And what about Beth? A swinger of my acquaintance told me of a well-worn tale in the scene. A husband drags the wife to a club, but once within the sanctum, the reluctant debutante becomes the belle of the ball, leaving the husband to dine on his own kishkas for the remainder of the evening. If there had, in fact, been some weird harmonic resonance between our hidden sexual selves and this banal bacchanal, by this point it would have been hard to hide it. The air was damp with newly emitted sweat. We had not witnessed any of the transactions leading to play because we weren't participating in them, but it seemed easy enough. We could approach any of the other couples in the room, cock an eyebrow, crook a finger. I looked at Beth, she at me, and we realized, as we gazed into each other's familiar faces in this very unfamiliar place with its exotic promises of sexual excess being fulfilled in thin-walled rooms all around us, not only that we were the most boring people in the club, but that we were the most bored.
Thanks for reading that, Peter. And why were you and your wife bored in the middle of this swingers club?
Well, I think that the best explanation for that and for a number of other phenomena that happened in the book came from Nina Hartley, who is, of course, perhaps one of the world's most well-known porn stars, who I interview in the book and got to be friends with. And it is her view, her, I think, extremely well-informed opinion, that the idea of sexual orientation goes far beyond the mere sort of straight gay paradigm that most people have, that, in fact, there's a lot of things to your sexual nature that are fixed, that you can't change no matter how much you might want to. And even without getting into how much we might have wanted to, I think that for a lot of people, these fantasies, if you will, these dreams of what these sort of pansexual scenes might be like, actually come crashing down when they realize they're just not wired that way.
Tell me more about why you wanted to explore vice and write the Book of Vice.
Well, to a certain extent, it's kind of just plain curiosity, a curiosity that I think a lot of people have but maybe don't admit to because of the things they're curious about. It's certainly something I've noticed in the kind of adventures that I've had in my life leading up to writing the book. Years ago, when I was a starving writer, a playwright, I got a job ghostwriting the memoirs of a woman who purported to be the leading female pornographic film impresario auteur director of the late 1970s. And I got this job, and various things ensued, none of which I expected, but one of the things I noted was that as I was telling people that I was working on this project, you know, all my cool artist friends living in garrets and so on and so forth, they were all really interested. They thought it was like the coolest day job they had ever heard. And it was my experience then, and it's been to a certain extent validated by the reaction to this book, most people are genuinely very curious about these sorts of things. And I think that a lot of people were in the position that I was in prior to writing the book, which is that they were wondering what the heck was going on in there. They hear about this stuff. They read various things in the news where this behavior sort of breaks out into public domain. And, you know, the paradigmatic example that I use in the book is something happened here in Illinois. Jack Ryan, a guy, was running for Senate in 2004, And his campaign kind of cratered when his divorce papers became public. And it turned out that his ex-wife, the actress Jeri Ryan, said that he had taken her to these sex clubs and demanded that she do various obscene things, and she had refused, and this led to their eventual parting. And the revelation of this ended his campaign, and his putative Democratic opponent, Barack Obama, ended up doing rather well. And this raised, at least in my mind, a lot of questions, like, what are these clubs? What do you do? How do you get in? I mean, is it a cash bar, or is it like Disneyland with an all-inclusive ticket? I mean, how do these things work?
Let's see if you can answer some of those questions for us. And why don't we start with the swingers club that
sure.
you went to? And I found it interesting that swinging, for people who are swingers, it's called the lifestyle.
Yes. I can tell you that the people I met incorporate this activity into their lives and do, in fact, think of it as separating themselves from what they see as the kind of staid, socially imposed morality of monogamous marriage. They think that's an artifice. They think that's repressing the rest of us. And they have figured out how to live in a way that's more true to true human nature. I mean, I had, I would say, a pleasant but definitely heated debate with one of these guys, the guy who ran this club, and who truly, as I say, devoted his life and sacred honor to this pursuit, about why I felt what I felt about marital monogamy and why you shouldn't cheat on your spouse. He thought this was entirely, you know, a function of, you know, social pressures, and it's just what I've been taught, and if only I realized the truth of human sexuality, then I would understand that everything they're doing was A-okay. Yeah, and these people do, in fact, pursue this, I think, somewhere beyond the avidity of a mere hobby, I will say that. I mean, stamp collecting is a hobby, so I think lifestyle is perhaps a more accurate term.
So how do people choose, like, who they're going to swing with?
I think they do it, I mean, in our view, they did it in the same way that you and I might, if we were at a party, might ask somebody to dance with.
So they have the choice. It's not like prearranged. There isn't like seating plan, so to speak, and you come in.
No, that would be funny, actually. That would be hilarious if you came in and there were little nameplates.
Right.
You know, little folded pieces of card and all the beds. Oh, look, we're sitting next to the Bernsteins tonight. How lovely. Now, that would be funny, but no, it's all very simple, and it's all very complex. What we saw, I mean, we didn't go to the point of actually participating, but what we saw, you know, you'd see two couples talking, and they're chatting, and they're laughing, and they're looking at each other, and then you look away, and you look back, and they're gone, and they went off to one of the many rooms reserved for that purpose.
My guest is Peter Sagal. He's the host of the NPR News Quiz, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And now he's the author of the new book, The Book of Vice, Very Naughty Things and How to Do Them. As you've said earlier, before you wrote this book, years ago, you were asked to ghostwrite the memoir of a woman who had directed many, or at least several, porn films, several that were supposed to be kind of classics in the field. And you consented to do this. What was supposed to be so special about this director?
Well, she had been, her name is Gail Palmer, and she was presented to me by her publishing house, who reached out to me to do the ghostwriting, as the preeminent female director of porn films back in the 70s or 80s, the era that the movie Boogie Nights so incredibly well documented. And what I expected, what everybody presented her to me as, is she would be this amazing sexual social rebel, this young woman who in an age of excess made it her lifestyle to do it. And I expected sort of this cool, gorgeous, pansexual woman who'd have leather clothes on and dyed hair and be surrounded by this sort of entourage of lovers of various sexes, and she'd be cool, and we'd talk about Simone Signoret and various other kinds of sexual rebellion because, you know, she was out there. She was a rebel. She was living it and doing it and making her money from doing it and blah, blah, blah. And I think that the reason that people, both me at that time in the mid-90s and people in her career in the late 70s and everybody who had encountered her imagined that is they so much wanted it to be true. Because what they're afraid of is that the porn industry is actually controlled by diamond, pinky-ringed, mob-connected pornographers who wear shirts down open to their pupic, as my grandmother would say, with lots of gold chains. And that's kind of gross, and we don't want to think that's what's lying behind all this exotic, thrilling stuff. And so, therefore, we'd like to imagine that it was this really cool, empowered woman who was doing it. Yeah, that kind of gives us a license. And what I found out, of course, is that she wasn't a diamond, pinky-ringed, hairy-chested, mob-connected pornographer. She was that guy's girlfriend. And she had essentially been, during her entire career, just that guy's front, because he knew exactly what we wanted, and he got his girlfriend to provide it by pretending to be the person making the movies.
At what point in the progress of ghostwriting her memoir did you realize that the whole story wasn't true?
Well, it was a long and slow process. I was maybe naive, but as the more I talked to her, the more I listened to her story and the way she would both justify her actions and yet deny ever having taken those actions, because she was trying to sell her story as both the story of a sinner and a story of a victim, I realized that there were these discontinuities and problems with her story. Both things that she was telling me at this moment couldn't be true. And finally, it actually came, after much suspicion on my part, it came in, of all things, a trial transcript. She had ended up being the witness against her boyfriend, paramour, in a tax evasion trial. And in the course of this trial, the attorneys, the prosecutors, asked her what her relationship to this man was, and she was asked about her role as the director of these films. You can't see me. I'm making air quotes when I say director. She was asked, it's like, well, did you actually direct these movies? And she said, well, no. So it was kind of, shall we say, a letdown.
So what did you do? I mean, you say in the book you kept writing. That since she couldn't really provide the story because her story wasn't true, you wrote your own version of the story.
Yes, well,
the person
you know.
You wanted her to be. But were you writing that as fiction or nonfiction?
Well, I was kind of. It was both an act of desperation because I desperately needed the money. As I said, I was a starving artist. I was responding to the pressure from everybody around her. Agent wanted the book to succeed. The publishers wanted the book to succeed. I wanted the book to succeed. I put so much time into it. And she wanted the book to succeed. So what I did was I took the events of her life, which were sort of the filmed records, the articles about her, and I kind of invented a new version of her that was the person that we all wanted her to be, that we'd all imagined her to be. I invented a Gail Palmer who was aware and ironic and rebellious and tough and cynical, that she, you know, that this character I'd invented didn't go so far as to believe all her own press, but she knew what she was doing and she did it willingly and knowingly and with kind of a smirk and a smile and sometimes a what the heck, let's just see what happens. And sort of a funny, I mean, I hate to say this, but, you know, I guess what I ended up writing was as if I had done what she had done, which was, shall we say, unlikely. You know, the sort of self-aware, ironic person who was always vaguely aware of how silly they were being.
But were you passing this off as memoir or fiction?
I was passing it off as a memoir, which was perhaps morally, shall we say, suspect. I mean, like I said, the differences became not what she did. I never said that she did anything she didn't do. The movies, I mean, she was on the set, so on and so forth. Let me put it this way. I admitted, or rather, in my writing, she admitted having done and having not done the things that she did and did not do. But she was, in my version, I think, more of a knowing participant in a kind of scam than she was in real life or wanted to present herself in real life. And she approved of this until the very last minute. I had finished the entire manuscript. She liked it. But in the end, she decided, no, that my version of her life story made her too complicit in her own life events. That the version of the story she wanted to tell was that she had been a victim. She had been fooled. She had been tricked. She had been forced. She had been afraid. And that's the version she wanted to stick to. So we came to a parting of the ways, and the manuscript was never published. It resides in my closet.
Did you get paid?
I got paid about half of what I was supposed to get paid, and it was kind of a problem.
So you were expecting Gail Palmer, the porn director who you were ghostwriting the memoir for. You expected her to look a certain kind of sexy, transgressive way. So what did she look like?
She looked like, what she was at that time, which was a Michigan housewife who wintered in Florida. She was wearing, if I remember her correctly, a kind of a velourish jumpsuit when I met her at the airport. She had a lot of makeup on and somewhat large hair. But she looked like, you know, somebody who spent their winters, down in Boca going and getting the early bird special at the various restaurants. And I went and spent some time with her there, and that's exactly what she did.
Something I found really interesting and quite paradoxical, the owner of this swingers club wanted the swingers in the club to be heterosexual couples in long-term, stable, honest relationships. And then they're going to have sex with other people?
Exactly. And that's what I couldn't quite figure out, because one of these things that these people will tell you is, this is not just about sex. We're not just here to get it on. We're here to get to know each other. We're here to get to know each other as people. It's wonderful. It's open. That's why my wife and I were welcome, even though we made it clear that we weren't going to be participating per se, because it's all about getting to know people. But, of course, it's not about getting to know people. If you want to get to know people, you go to your office Christmas party. You go to a bar. I mean, this was you know, the reason people were coming to this location by invitation only and paying $60 as a fee for expenses. I mean, we know why they were there. And it seems to me, or it seemed to me, that the primary thing that they're trying to do is they're trying to arrange the maximum amount of sexual opportunities for themselves with the minimum amount of emotional involvement. But my feeling about it is that that can't be true, that they are aware of all the emotional complications of physical intimacy. Otherwise, they wouldn't go to such great extent to make sure that those emotional complications don't come up. And that's why I wanted to go, to see if that was at all possible. They say it is.
Yes, and now I get to ask a question I don't usually get to ask on Fresh Air, which is, describe the orgy room.
Oh, the orgy room. This is very exciting. This
and by exciting, in which way did you mean that?
No, I mean, actually, here's the funny thing. I don't mean it. I don't mean that it was exciting. Again, and I think this has to go to my own sort of particular whatever, neuroses or hang-ups. They have a number of rooms at this place. Many of them have doors. You go in the room, you close the door, and the rules are is don't knock on the door. Whoever's inside has whatever and whomever they need. One room, though, was the exception. Nothing but a curtain that was open the whole time. And the rule was anything that goes on in that room, anybody can come in and watch, and if they're invited, participate. The people in there want at least other people seeing. And that was a really popular room. It turns out that one of the things that these people are into is not just, shall we say, a plethora of partners, but also, performance. We met one couple, and the reason they came there was simply to, and there was a committed couple, lived together. They were monogamous with each other, but they liked to come there and be intimate with each other, if I can keep it in the public radio vein, be intimate with each other in full view. This is what made them happy. And other people presumably were happy to accommodate them in this. That was sort of part of the scene. And again, we get back to, you know, a kind of sense of, well, these people are wired in a particular way. For my part, I poked my head in because we were looking around, just my head, and was kind of vaguely embarrassed. I was like, ooh, I'm sorry, did I open the wrong door? I'm sorry, backing up. I'll just go over here and have another Fig Newton back on the refreshment table. Sorry.
So, what surprised you most about your reaction at the Swingers Club?
I think it was this that I was as uninterested in participating as I ended up being. And because I think that, again, this book began out of a sense of curiosity. What would it be like to travel in these realms of gold and to, you know, we hear about Plato's retreat back in the 70s, you know, this fantastic era of sexual excess and hedonism. And, I mean, as I say in the book, not for nothing was it named after the inventor of the eternal ideal. And I think I imagine that if only we could have access to these places, if only we could go to these places where the rules are finally released, we would finally be able to experience our hedonistic selves and, you know, reveal ourselves to be the fabulous, you know, Roman-level connoisseurs of pleasure that we are just dying to be, if only we could be allowed to be. And the answer is no. In my case, no, I'm not really like that. I live a vanilla life because I'm a vanilla guy, which is, you know, kind of comforting.
Do you know, after seeing people who were otherwise kind of ordinary people with regular jobs and stuff, after seeing them in the Swingers Club, do you walk around the streets now thinking, like, you never know who the swinger is, you never know who the exhibitionist is, you never know what's going on underneath the surface?
You never do. You absolutely never do, you know. And in fact, ironically, a couple of days after I visited the Swingers Club, I was still in the same city where it was, and I saw one of the people walking down the street, you know, in his tie and suit. And I'm like, And of course, well, I'm not like, I'm like, oh, it's that guy. He was a nice guy when I talked to him. And then, of course, he took all his clothes off, and that was awkward. I mean, yeah, one of the things you find out when you go to these places, as I say in the book, and the cliche is true, these are all doctors and lawyers, accountants, teachers, And that's who, I mean, if you're a rock star, you know, then you don't need to go to these clubs to indulge your hedonistic self if you have one. These are the people who show up. They're your neighbors. And matter of fact, most of these places, these private swingers clubs, this one happened to be in a city, most of them are in the suburbs because that's where doctors, lawyers, married accountants live.
Peter, before you started hosting Wait, Wait, could you have answered any of the news questions? Did you follow the news closely enough to have answered them?
Well, that's the terrifying fact. The answer is yes. My only qualification to be on the show, to host the show, I had no experience in public radio, was that I was a news junkie. I was a writer, so of course I looked for something to procrastinate, some way to procrastinate, and my chosen method was to obsessively read newspapers. I can't get to work on my play. I've got to read the Bolding scores and the Agate type, I'd say, and work my way through the paper. And so, yeah, and then, of course, the curse is, you know, it became my job. It became my job to be obsessive about news trivia. Be careful what you wish for, America, because now how am I supposed to procrastinate? I procrastinate by, like, I don't know, doing my taxes.
Do you read the newspapers obsessively with a different eye now than you used to, because now you're looking with an eye for what could be a funny question?
Yeah, and that's actually kind of sad, and it's kind of warped me because, you know, like the significant news of the day, the disasters, the political movements, the things that actually affect the world in its course, I have to ignore. Turn to page, you know, A8 to the oddly enough column and see what dumb thing the latest bank robber left behind at the bank. Was it his resume this time? Was it his headshot if he was an actor? I mean, to a certain extent, my view of the news has been skewed by my job, which is the goofy, the dumb, the silly. Of course, I can't look at the news without thinking about what goofy, dumb, silly thing I'm going to have to say about it come the end of the week.
Peter, how much of what you say on the show is scripted and how much of it is improvised?
A lot of it is scripted. Well, this is what happens. We go through the week's news. We work very hard to find the stories we're going to talk about, to decide what we're going to say about those stories. At the end of the week, as we get ready for our taping, we sit down. I write a lot of the material. My colleagues write a lot of the material. I go over it in the theory that I got to have to say it. We change it. We read it out loud. We change it. We improve it. We change our attack. We pick new jokes. And then we get up in front of an audience, about 500 people usually, at our home theater in Chicago with our three panelists, and we kind of throw that thing against the wall and see what sticks. And a lot of times, the stuff that I wrote, the stuff that my colleagues wrote, that ends up being great. But more to the point, it's usually the spontaneous interaction between myself, the callers, the panelists. We've done good material, and I'm proud of having written it. The best material I think we've done on the show is the stuff that just arose spontaneously in that room. And I think that, to a great extent, is the appeal of the show. That, you know, we, to a certain extent, I like to think of our show as sort of a peer of the Colbert Report and the Daily Show and Jay Leno's monologues and Letterman's monologues. Well, those are brilliant, and those are amazingly well written. And I don't know if I could ever be as that smart or clever. But what I can do is I can get these people in a room with me and, like, let things happen. And sometimes the spontaneity of it, I think, makes up for, shall we say, my lack of wit.
The biggest, I think it's fair to say, the biggest or one of the biggest gets you've ever had on your show is Patrick Fitzgerald, the prosecutor who was investigating the Valerie Plame leak and won a conviction against Scooter Libby. Everybody wanted to talk to him. He wasn't talking to the media, but he was a contestant on a regular segment of your show, which is called Not My Job, in which the contestant has to answer questions that have nothing to do with what they do professionally. And I want to play an excerpt of that segment that you did with him.
So it's great to have you here.
Thanks.
So who leaked Valerie Plame's name? Come on. I know. You're not going to say. You're not going to say. My first question.
Do you think you're going to catch him off balance on that?
No. He wasn't expecting that.
Don't.
No, we know that you can't and would even prefer not to speak about your work. But I have to ask you one question. What in the world are you doing here? Because you don't actually do a lot of press, but you're here. We're delighted. But what made you decide to join us?
Literally, I was trying to get tickets to the show. I got them.
You got them?
Yeah. But I've been asking myself that question recently.
I imagine. All of a sudden, it's
very recently.
What am I doing here? Can you rethinking? So you live in the city here in Chicago.
Yes.
You moved here from New York.
Yes.
And you like it here.
A lot.
You live in the North Side, I'm told. out there in one of our neighborhoods. One of our neighborhoods. And you work downtown.
Yes.
Right. So let me ask you, how do you feel about commuting?
I don't mind driving.
No. There we go.
That's Patrick Fitzgerald with Peter Sagal on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Peter, it took me a second to get the commuting joke. I mean, did he have any regrets about coming on? I mean, he really was not doing media.
No, he wasn't. And in fact, you know, you heard me ask him in front of, and we were in front of 10,000 people at a park in downtown Chicago for a special summer event. So I think I was just as nervous as he was that day. He doesn't do a lot of media, and I asked him the same question that I asked him in front of those people, i.e., why are you doing this, prior to going on stage, and he gave me a slightly more serious answer. And he said because he can't answer the media's questions because they want to ask him about the important things that he did that he can't talk about, the prosecution of Scooter Libby and other such things. But he could answer our questions because our questions were going to be silly. And I kind of appreciate that. One of the things that we are able to do in our little tiny place in the media universe is give serious people a break and ask them questions that they don't usually get. He seemed to enjoy it, at least before he came on stage. The one thing that he was funny about was at the end of his appearance, again in front of 10,000 people, we gave him a parting gift. Never done this before. We got a little kid's scooter, and in front of 10,000 people, we gave it to him. And I read out the plaque that was on the scooter, and the plaque said, to Patrick Fitzgerald, USA, from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, this one will stay where you put it. And everybody laughed, and he laughed, and he thanked me, and then he put the scooter down, and he tried to walk off stage. And I said, no, you forgot your scooter. And he looked at me mortified, and everybody laughed and cheered for him to pick up the scooter. And he knew what would happen if he did, and sure enough, he did. He picked up the scooter, flash bulbs flashed all over the place, and the next day, that was in the New York Times, of Patrick Fitzgerald standing there looking awkward, holding a child's scooter.
But he was okay with that?
He was a little bit embarrassed, I think. He walked off stage, and he put it down, and he left without it. And the next day, his staff called, and they demanded it. They wanted it back. I think they thought it was a bit of a trophy. He I think, was a little embarrassed about the whole thing. But I have a feeling he enjoyed it. I have a feeling that after all the things that had been said about him, after his inability to respond to the various attacks in the media made on him, I think he enjoyed getting up in front of a lot of people there in the park and on our radio audience and just being a decent human being, which he profoundly is.
Is there any moment on Wait, Wait that you wish you could take back, that you wish never happened, where you felt like you made a bit of a fool of yourself? So tell it to us now.
Yes, exactly.
Do it a second time.
Because, for some reason, I've never minded very much seeming the idiot on the radio. I don't know why. I think rather me than them. I remember I once called Helen Thomas a little old lady to her face, which made her very mad. And I kind of regretted that, but her response was so delightful and non-little old lady-like that I was happy to sacrifice myself. Slightly more seriously, one mistake I made was I did some jokes about the death of Steve Irwin, the crocodile hunter, right after he died. And because I thought it was kind of odd the way that he had died and strange. And I made comments to the effect, I'm now going to get myself in even worse trouble, that in a weird way, he'd been asking for it. All those years, he'd been chasing after animals and grabbing them by the tails, you know. And I made a joke about, you know, how at the memorial service for him, all the animals were sitting around with their cocktails and looking down to the floor, and finally somebody said, you know, I didn't like him that much. He grabbed my tail. I didn't like that. We got more letters of protest about that than for anything we've ever done, ever. The vicious things we've said about the President of the United States, of both parties, their various treasonous imprecations of our government, people are cool. I made fun of Steve Irwin the week after he died, and our audience was very unhappy with me.
Maybe it's because he died. I mean, maybe because, saying bad things about the dead. And
yeah, there's that. And there was what I didn't realize that he meant a lot to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I think the things I said were kind of valid, but what I learned is that, you know, basically my job is not to tell people what to think. My job is to be entertaining to people and to give them a break from the week's news, and invoking a tragedy in that way did not make anybody feel entertained or happy, and it was something I regret.
It must be hard, though, to figure out where to draw the line. It's your job to be funny. It's your job to be fearless, because if you're not fearless, you're not going to be funny when it comes to satire. And at the same point, there is, I suppose, a line that you can cross over where it just becomes offensive to many people.
Exactly right. And we cross that line every week, at least judging from our mail. We get at least one letter a week. And the letter goes like this. Dear Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, I am a very funny person. I have a wonderful sense of humor, and I love your show. In other words, the disclaimer, I'm not a drip. And then they say, but this week you made fun of X, left-handed Zamboni drivers. And don't you understand that left-handed Zamboni drivers is a very serious topic and you couldn't make fun of it, and I demand an on-air apology. We get a lot of demands for on-air apologies. And in place of X or left-handed Zamboni drivers, we've had everything from Republicans to Democrats to the president to the troops to the generals to the privates to politicians to fat people to skinny people to goths. One of my favorite was protesting our treatment of the goth community and that I needed to make an on-air apology. If we did all the on-air apologies that people are asking us for, we'd have to do 2 hours a week, an hour to do the show and then an hour to apologize for it. And as you say, it's, you know, if you're going to do this well, you're going to do it in a way that is going to annoy somebody. And if you're not annoying anybody, then you're probably not doing it right.
Well, it's nice to know you have a way of filling time in case somebody ever cancels on you.
Exactly. And now we're just going to apologize for the last 3 weeks' worth of shows. It'll take a while, so get a nice warm beverage to keep you company. Yes, believe me.
What about politically? Does anybody do you have any editorial people saying to you, you can't criticize the president like that? You can't mock the president like that?
Oh no! I mean, our show went on the air in January of 1998, 2 weeks before the name Monica Lewinsky hit the news. And so we basically spent our first 6 months of this show, when we were on very few stations and didn't know what the heck we were doing, basically living as a parasite off of making fun of the president. That president, which is something I point out to sometimes when people think that we have it in for this president, that's our bread and butter, is making fun of powerful people. And when people write in to say, oh, you shouldn't make fun of this person who's in charge, you don't like the president, I say, I'll be happy to make fun of somebody else. Please elect them, and we'll be happy to do it. And then they usually go away.
My guest is Peter Sagal, the host of NPR's news quiz Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and the author of the new book, The Book of Vice. You've been doing Wait, Wait from theaters, you know, in front of an audience. You must be very comfortable doing that because you started off in the theater. I mean, you were writing plays before you were doing Wait, Wait. So theaters are kind of like home for you, I guess, in some way.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in the years we did the show in the studio, talking into a microphone, I never liked it. I never felt comfortable. I mean, Ira Glass gave me some advice, you know, the classic advice. You always think of, you're talking to just one person. But I could never imagine who that one person was, and they kept changing. And whenever I imagined them, they were looking at me with a look of vague disapproval. It was not a happy thing. But you put me in front of an audience, people who I can see, people whose reactions I can gauge, and I'm much more comfortable. I mean, it's weird. I have a lot of anxieties. I have a lot of neuroses. But standing in front of a large group of people, not one of them. I could do that all day, and some days I have. So, yeah, it's and plus we're doing a comedy show. And if you say something funny in front of a large group of people, they might laugh, which turns out to be kind of an incentive to be funnier. So it actually has worked out fabulously well. So, yeah, I one of the great things about my job is I get to put on a play every week.
This might seem like an overly personal question, so feel free to say you don't want to answer it. Do you remember your first pornography, like the first time you saw a pornographic, you know, or a sexually explicit magazine or book?
Well, I write about the first time I saw a pornographic film in the book because, you know, and so I'm happy to talk to you about it now. It was very weird. It was exactly the wrong way. It was I just arrived at college at Harvard in the early 1980s, and I was hanging out with my roommates, and I just met them, and we were like, oh, let's be cool, let's be fun, let's do cool college things. And one of those things was to go down to the midnight showing at the Harvard Square Theater and see a movie called Cafe Flesh, which is this kind of avant-garde porn movie that was made in the late 80s. I'm sorry, the late 70s. And so there it was, you know. So I'm sitting next to these guys who I didn't know really well and watching this thing on this, you know, wide screen. And the movie began and you know, it pretty much, after the appropriate prelude, got down to business. And I remember feeling very uncomfortable sitting there experiencing that in the company of my newfound friends. This is when you're planning your first exposure to pornography, don't do it in public. That would be my advice. One of the things I remember about it was how stark it was, how utterly biological it was. It was very surprising to me. There's something about, you know, that kind of film that is, again, shockingly brutal zoologically. You know, this isn't about romance. This isn't about décolletage. This isn't about flirting. This is about, you know, anatomical charts come to life. And that, I think, was a bit of a shock to my young and impressionable mind.
Again, this might be too personal, but...
Hey, you're Terry Gross. I'm ready for it.
So were you always like a sexually confident person?
Oh, geez. Have you heard nothing I had to say? Not at all. And in fact, I mean, haven't you been listening, Terry? I mean, and to a certain extent, writing this whole book is like wanting to talk to these sexually confident people and saying, how do you do it? What is the nature of sexual confidence? What does it mean? How do you carry yourself, you know, if you're sexual? But what, if I wanted to pretend to be sexually confident, how should I wear my hair? Although in my case, it's an irrelevant question. My goodness. No, of course not. And I never was. And I think that most people aren't. I really do. And I think that a lot of the things that I'm writing about are things that the sexually unconfident like myself wonder about and puzzle out because it makes so little sense to them. For example, you know, there's a whole chapter in my book on strip clubs. And one of the things that I couldn't figure out about strip clubs, having the few times I've been in one, like in a bachelor party, is I sat there and always asked myself the dumbest possible question you could ask in a strip club, which is, what do these girls think of me? You know, do they like me? And of course, you know, anybody who goes to strip clubs out of habit will say, well, that the whole reason of going to a strip club is that you don't have to ask that question, do you? That's the whole appeal of them, I ultimately found out, is that it relieves us of the burden, and sometimes it is a burden, of having to present ourselves as human beings.
Peter Sagal, it's been great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Terry Gross, it has been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me.
Peter Sagal is the host of NPR's news quiz, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and author of The Book of Vice, Very Naughty Things and How to Do Them. This is Fresh Air.